Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded, though, by people who can support us, your family, friends, and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Tantrums, meltdowns, hitting, biting, lying, screaming, no! It's all fairly normal behaviour for toddlers navigating the world around them and how they fit into it. However, they're not neurologically equipped to regulate their emotions. That's something we need to demonstrate. I'll admit it, parenting isn't for the faint-hearted. As the most important role humans can undertake, it's also the most challenging and one we don't always have the tools and skills to prepare us. To make things even more challenging, we also carry generational modelling. You know that voice in your head from your childhood, which tells us how to manage a situation? We're learning that it might not be the best course of action. Returning to what we teach our children this week is author and speaker Carrie Sutton, who shares the latest research and her own wisdom of parenting in raising a mentally fit generation. With over 30 years' experience predominantly in early childhood and diverse needs education, she is recognised internationally for her knowledge and mission to change the conversation about how we promote and protect children's mental health and well-being. Hello, Carrie. It's so good to have you back. What was it about your experience that prompted you to want to share it with the world?
Yeah, interesting question. And the reason I wrote it is because most probably for the past at least 10 to 15 years, what I have seen is a decline in children's mental health. And I'm not a mental, so I'm a trained guidance officer as well, and I've been a guidance officer in schools. However, what I could see was a lack of resilience, a lack of ability to understand and regulate emotions, a lack of emotional intelligence. And what worries me is, because I am an early childhood educator at heart, I know that these skills can be taught. We don't come out of the womb having emotional intelligence. We don't come out of the womb understanding how to regulate ourselves. And in fact, and I try and talk to educators about this and families, self-regulation actually is not cognitively possible until most probably about 5-6 years of age. So we're asking early childhood children, or toddlers and kindergarten and preschool children, to regulate their behaviours. We actually need to co-regulate with them, because the prefrontal cortex and the brain structure is not there yet to actually regulate their emotions, because they just don't have it. They also don't have the language to explain their emotions. So this is critically important. And often, and it was really fascinating, I was listening to a podcast the other day. Lewis Howes had a podcast, was on a podcast, and he said, people aren't being taught these skills. We've got a generation of parents almost who haven't been taught these emotional literacy skills and these sorts of things. And it's not parents' fault. There is no parenting manual. So what I want, and why I wrote Raising a Mentally Fit Generation, is to look and say, these are tools that we can give our children to do certain things. We want to have them to have tools for life. So whether it's to keep their brains healthy, to keep their bodies healthy, to keep their emotions healthy, these are things we can furnish them with.
Why is it so important to have the ability to regulate our emotions in life in general?
Because we are emotional beings. We are herd animals. And if you look at a herd, nobody wants to be outcast. because being outcast and being left alone or being isolated fires off our amygdala. If we're frightened of that, if we're concerned and fearful of that, that frightens our amygdala, and our amygdala takes over. We have a brain flip. The prefrontal cortex goes off. Our amygdala takes over and goes, you have to do whatever it is to fit in with the herd because you will be safe, to fit in with your family, to fit in with your friends. And if we can't control our emotions, what often happens is that children will perform socially isolating behaviors. And what I mean by, I know that sounds really crazy, but they'll do things like have tantrums, hurt people, possibly throw chairs, throw furniture, get angry, bite, kick, scratch, because they don't have the language. So we're used to seeing this as parents, as early childhood educators, we're used to seeing this in smaller children. So in children from toddler age up until about three, because that's when they really start learning and we start modeling for them. But if they don't get these skills and they continue these behaviors when they're 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 12, 16, they're still throwing tantrums. And when I say they still do it, behavior is a form of communication. And if you're performing a behavior, it is generally because it's worked before to get you what you want. So as a 16-year-old, if you want everybody to bugger off and leave you alone and you don't have the language to say that or you don't have the emotional vocabulary to say that, what you'll do is perform behaviours that have worked before to get people to leave you alone.
This is interesting because through the 60s and 70s, most parents took on a behavioralist modelling to their parenting. So given that and what we're learning now about sitting in, you know, your emotional intelligence when you're dealing with children who can't regulate theirs, what problems do we see arise?
All behaviour is a form of communication. It's displaying something, whether we be adults, if we get angry and we're displaying angry behaviours, often anger is driven by fear. So it's the flip side of fear. So there is our behavior is communicating something. Possibly our boundaries have been violated. So an adult's emotional iceberg is different to a child's. A child's emotional iceberg, the behaviors at the top, they're angry or frustrated, and you're seeing this anger or tantrum or a challenging behavior. What's going on underneath? And I often say to parents, look, I know, and particularly when you're trying to get out the door and the kid throws themselves on the floor and screams, there are times you can do it and times you can't. Times you may just have to pick them up, put them under your arm and go, we're going, and off. But the majority of the time, if at all possible, can you sit with that, help them co-regulate and say things like, I can see that you are really angry, because what you're communicating is I get that something has upset you. I see that you're really frustrated. Maybe I don't understand. I can't understand what's happened, and they may not have the words for it at the time. It could have been something that happened earlier in the morning. It could have been, if you think of as an adult, we can get hangry very quickly. Hungry and tired often produces hangry and an angry response. Children don't know they're getting tired, so they may come to a point where it is just full-on meltdown and they don't have the words to say, I'm really tired, I just want to go to bed, or I just need a nap, please, or can you just give me a cuddle? So we need to, as adults, look and go, what could possibly be underneath? Don't just judge that this is behavior that's trying to get up your nose, because I can guarantee you that children do not wake up in the morning and say, how can I irritate my parents or teachers today? They just don't do it. They're the 99.99999% of children. There are some children I've met that possibly that, but they are few and far between in my 30 years. The majority of children do not wake up thinking, how can I get up people's noses? They generally don't have the skills to manage the situation that's in front of them, and therefore you get the behavior. And that behavior then causes other people to look at them a bit funny, if it's in an educational setting, which could then affect friendships. This is why emotional regulation, and again, research has shown over and over again, and you'll know, I guess you've heard of the marshmallow experiment?
No.
Okay, so there was a marshmallow experiment. It was done in the 60s and it looked at delayed gratification and self-regulation. So there was a marshmallow on the table and the researcher said to children, I'm going to go out of the room. I've just got to go get some paper. If you don't eat the marshmallow while I'm gone, you will get two when I get back. You'll get another one when I can have two. So they traced those outcomes. The children who didn't eat the marshmallow generally had better self-regulation and delayed gratification. And so with that, the life outcomes then from having those traits were better. So they did better in school, they had more friends, all of those sorts of things. And they looked, so it was a longitudinal study. It wasn't just study about marshmallows right then and there. But it's that sort of thing. It's understanding that, you know, somebody could have upset me, but it may not be about me. Right then and there, somebody may have said something harsh to me, but I don't go back and get arguing with them and bang heads with them because I realize it's not about me. It could be about what's going on for them. And that's emotional intelligence. That's self-regulation, because that person may have said things to you that might have wanted you to bop them in the nose. But that's not going to be a positive outcome for you if you do that. That's why, and unfortunately we see it now, we're seeing it in teenagers. They don't have self-regulation. The attention spans are shorter, self-regulation. And I'm not having a go at teenagers, but what I'm worried about is that they're losing these skills, because these skills are needed, whether it be in a workplace, and I'm not saying a workplace like going and showing up to work, whether your life is a team sport, we have to get on with others. And so self-regulation helps us do that in a civil way.
Well, they've also been introduced to so much more information, so much more access in a consumeristic society, and that instant gratification is a real thing. What role has that all played in the teenagers we see now?
That worries me enormously, because you see online, like people shop online, like, and I don't mean online through Amazon, but there is like TikToks and other things where people can just scroll and shop immediately. This concerns me, one, for financial literacy and financially down the road for these kids, but two, it's actually about going, you know, what can we do to teach our kids that you do need to delay gratification sometimes? Because ultimately, delayed gratification also has to do with hope, that you know that things are going to get better. And some of our young people these days, and you'd be aware of it as well, they don't have hope, and so they're making decisions that have ramifications for their lives because they can't see beyond what's happening right now.
I see a lot of parents, younger parents than I, obviously I'm a grandparent now, but I see a lot of parents feeling guilty if they're not giving their children the things that other children their age have. What do you do as a parent? It's hard to say no to children. Have you had to deal with that yourself?
With Mitchell, yes, I did. And also, this is one of the pieces of advice I got from Michael Carr-Gregg years ago when he's, because he's young men, his sons are now most probably in their mid to late 20s, if not 30s. And Michael Carr-Gregg said, you know, I'm willing to be the bad guy. I'm willing to be the person who has the rule that phones and everything else get put on a table at dinner time or at 8 o'clock or whenever, and then they go to bed. Because what teenagers need is an excuse. They want to fit in desperately. They want to have that. But if their parent can, if they can say, oh, the old man's such a frigging dragon or whatever, he makes me do this, that gives them an out, so they don't have to be responding at 3 a.m. in the morning to texts that come through. It's the same thing as I don't know if I've discussed this with you before, but if they find themselves in a situation, and I talk to families about this, if your teenager finds themselves in a situation, have an emoji that they can send you, so it doesn't look like anything, that means I need you to call me and I need an out. What they do is they send that emoji, and I say to parents, do not, it now is not the time for discussion. When this happens, if this happens at 2 a.m., 1 a.m., whatever, it's not the time for discussion. It's not the time for yelling at people. It's the time to ring them and say, there's been a family emergency. Where are you? I'll come get you. You can have the discussion. Do not have the discussion in the car on the way home. Say, you know what? We both need to get some sleep. In the morning, we're going to talk about this or whatever. And then you can have the discussion about what happened or whatever. But it's about giving kids a way out, because, again, we're herd animals. children want to fit in. They want to have an iPhone. They want to have TikTok. They want to have all of those things. But I think it's going to be interesting and it's fascinating. I was speaking to a lawyer. I went to an International Women's Day breakfast and she was a lawyer. And she found out I was doing my PhD in digital resilience and she said, I'd love to talk to you because I'm the generation that had unlimited access and I wish I hadn't. I wish that somebody had put boundaries in place for me.
Well, isn't that what parenting's all about though, is having boundaries so that children understand life is about boundaries.
And that's the critical part again. It's because self-regulation comes back to like when we're teaching children how to self-regulate, I know you're angry. I know you're really upset at your brother for knocking your castle over. However, it's not okay to pull his hair and slam his head into the floor. It's okay to be angry. It's not okay to hurt people when you are angry. We could pop bubble wrap. We could go outside and run. We could rip up some paper, or you can give them options to deal with their anger. And all emotions are valid. Emotions are data. So every emotion a child has, that's valid. And we validate that. It's okay for them to feel that way. The behavior is a different thing. And that's what self-regulation is. It's learning that it's okay to be angry. It's not okay to hurt somebody because of that or punch holes in the wall.
That's very powerful. And that's true. And it's something, you know that we know, we can actually implement. However, I think we're still caught in this generational idea. I had a baby boomer I was talking to in the last week who was saying that we're now living in a soft society. I don't feel like that's true. But, you know, how can we overcome that type of thinking in society and feel good about doing this?
We're not talking about mollycoddling kids. I'm not talking about wrapping kids in bubble wrap. I'm actually saying age-appropriate risk is important and allowing them to get online is important, but we have to give them the skills in early childhood and with the skills to critically evaluate information, to understand that an algorithm is going to feed them things over and over again. If they click on a certain thing, they're going to see more of that. We have to give them age-appropriate consequences, natural consequences. You know, we've had a lot of, and I know you're going around the world with this podcast, but in Australia, we've had a lot of situations where girls and boys at school have been made to feel uncomfortable by their classmates. And what's happened, and it's been interesting that this discussion has been played out in the media as well, what's happened is, oh, well, they might get an apology or they might be suspended for a day or whatever it is. There needs to be a natural consequence. If you do this socially inappropriate behavior, then there is going to be a consequence. I'm not talking about punishment or corporal punishment. What I'm saying is, what is the natural consequence for that? You look back tribally, thousands of years, there were natural consequences. And people learned you don't do that. Now, I'm not saying we allow children to put their hands on hot plates, but if a child puts its hand on a hot plate or something that's hot, it goes, ow, that's a natural consequence. I don't go put my child's hand on a hot plate, but I tell them that it will be hot. And I say to them, like bath water, it is hot. We do not want to touch, like you don't touch that. We have to talk to the older generations again, because as you said, talking to older generations is so very important, especially about for things like consent for younger children as well, because again, I've seen this time and time again, they should want to be cuddled by me. They should want me to touch them. If a child doesn't want something to happen, because children in our society still don't have that power, we have every right as their parent, as their grandparent, as their aunt, if we see a discomfort, to say, you know, that's not okay. Sally, I see the look on your face. Does that make you uncomfortable? And they might just nod or their eyes get wide. And you say, hey, Grandpa, or hey, Uncle Bert, or hey, Grandma, they don't like you doing that. Would you mind stopping, please? And that, again, I've heard boomers and other generations say, oh, you're mollycoddling. No, we're actually teaching them that somebody will recognize their sign of distress, that somebody will help them stand up for their boundaries and say, it's my body. I don't like it when you do that. But particularly for young children, they don't have the language to do that. And it's always been the case of, oh, it's just auntie so-and-so. Yeah, they might pinch your cheeks or do whatever. That's okay. It's just them. But I don't like it. I don't want them to pinch my cheeks. It hurts. So there are a lot of generational differences, and they, and I'm not having a go. That's how they were raised, and that's fine. But what we're seeing now is that we need to teach our children from a young age that it's okay to feel feelings. If you wonder about that, and I know I'm talking about an Australian context at the moment, look at the rate of mental health and suicide problems that are facing our 20 to 40-year-olds, particularly men. That concerns me gravely, because often it's boys who are toughen up, or we don't talk about that, or things like that. It's actually about going, you know what, it is okay to be sad. It's okay to be angry.
It's okay to have emotions, regardless of gender.
Absolutely.
We need to start having these conversations a little more.
That's why I wanted to write Raising a Mentally Fit Generation, because it talks about those things. It talks about giving our children the skills they need to operate in an environment that is changing rapidly. The other day, a parent contacted me and said, I'm horrified. My child was watching something that I thought Peppa Pig was on. So she looked at the screen. It looked like Peppa Pig. When she came back and really looked at it, it was a Peppa Pig lookalike that these creators had created, but it was stabbing people. This is what's happening on YouTube and shorts and things like that. They're making these things look similar, so children think it's that, so parents think it's that, and then our children are watching this content. So we actually have to look at and decide, as parents, as educators, as a society, how are we going to tackle this? How are we going to move forward and help our children have the tools and skills they need?
Well, the one thing I'm taking away from today is how proud I am of my daughter for sticking to her guns with an 11, 10 and 9-year-old and not allowing them to have access to YouTube, which was one of the big ones you just mentioned, not allowing them to have access to World Wide Web unsupervised, and they aren't getting a workaround because they don't have devices that can access the internet.
Yeah.
Carrie, it's been wonderful reconnecting with you, and I look forward to having further conversations, particularly around the digital child.
Thanks, Kim.
That's author, speaker and early childhood consultant, Carrie Sutton, who believes we should all be committed to mental fitness, sharing her parenting experience and scientific research that underpins all of the components of her book, Raising a Mentally Fit Generation. From teaching brain basics to encouraging kindness and empathy, you'll discover a range of resources and practical exercises that foster family resilience and well-being. As usual, all the links are in the show notes. To connect with me, go to my website, kimkleidon.com. That's KimKleidon.com. If you know someone who's being the change they want to see in the world, nominate them to be a guest on the program. Until next time, thanks for listening. This podcast is recorded in Launchpad Studios thanks to Greater Whitsunday Innovation, formerly Split Spaces.